Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here, of course, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you've been doing a lot of writing of late on the nuclear deal with Iran, a deal that's going to be voted on in Congress by next month. Some of the critics of this agreement on the right have taken to comparing it to the Munich Agreement with Hitler in 1938. And of course, people on the left respond, well, you guys, you know, you compare everything with Munich. Is the comparison persuasive to you?
Yeah, I think with the necessary adjustments being made, it is. The big objection on the left is that we are very strong and Iran is very weak, and Hitler was very strong and Britain and the Allies were weak, and that's just not true. The Third Reich in 1938, in almost every classification of tank caliber, quantity, was weaker than the combined forces of France and Britain, and much weaker than the Soviet Union. And had the liberal democracies, Belgium, Holland, France, Britain, along with Czechoslovakia and Poland, and probably the Soviet Union, had a common front, they could have easily deterred Hitler. That was something that's not debatable. Hitler said that himself when he went and viewed the Skoda arms work and the fortifications in occupied Czechoslovakia. So that's one thing to keep in mind, that there was no reason to appease Hitler. And, of course, Iran is much weaker. And then, of course, the administration always evokes the arms limitation treaties with the Soviet Union. And that's, again, I think, a distortion of history. Obama doesn't quite understand that they had a number of nukes aimed at us, and we didn't have a lot of options. We have a lot of options right now with Iran. They don't yet have a deplorable nuclear weapon that's been miniaturized to fit on an intercontinental missile. So we're not under threat of our own Holocaust the way that John Kennedy was, that to evoke President Obama's recent speech the other day. And so I don't quite see what the urgency was. Iran was suffering under stepped up economic sanctions, and it came to us and wanted to negotiate. There were no urgency on our part, except in a very strange way, Obama's legacy and his tenure is running out. And after Obamacare and open borders and a lot of problems from Benghazi all the way to reset, there wasn't a lot of legacies there to pass on for after his departure. So I think what he felt was he had to do this deal with as much urgency as the Iranians did. And the Iranians, of course, wanted the sanctions lifted. They wanted the cash freed up. They wanted the oil out of their storage farms. And they were pretty afraid that the next president, no matter who it is, could not be better for them than Obama. Could not be, you know. So I think they had a sense of urgency as great as Obama's.
So you're not biting on the president's argument that he's been making more strenuously the last couple of days, that basically the only options that were available for the American people here were this deal or war.
No, there's an irony to that, because this deal will ensure war of some sort, because 75 years after the Holocaust, the Israelis are not going to put their hands and their security, their livelihood, onto empty assurances from Iran that they're going to abide by agreement when they've never abided by any agreement. One of the weird things about Obama's speech the other day was, within 48 hours of delivering an argument why we should all, in the United States and abroad, accept this agreement, is that General Soleimani, who was the Quds commander, Revolutionary Guard head that spearheaded the Iranian effort to kill Americans in Iraq and was supposedly under an international travel ban, went right to Vladimir Putin, probably to arrange arms sales. And then the ranking Democrat in the Senate, who may well be the Senate minority leader, perhaps the majority leader after the next election, Chuck Schumer, came out against the deal. So it's just not the right wing or me or other people who are skeptical. When you have the ranking Democrat in the Senate and showing skepticism, and you're trying to convince people that Iran will abide by deals, and then immediately their top terrorist doesn't, it's not a good sign at all.
You wrote in one of your pieces recently, I'm quoting you here, "The danger of an aggressor is never just the specter of raw power, but instead the insidious messages about using what it has that it sends to more responsible parties," close quote. And you argue, in essence, that when more benign regimes back down because of this, it doesn't just change the dynamic with the aggressor nation. It can actually shift the calculus in an entire region. Explain that.
Yeah, I think what Iran is doing is just what Hitler did. A lot of things happen when appeasement is attempted and ultimately fails. But Hitler told everybody in the German high command, General Halder, General Jodl, "See you guys, I told you to take gambles. I was right all along." And then all of the dissidents within Germany were shown to be wrongheaded and that they had put their faith in democratic opposition to Hitler. But more importantly, it empowered Hitler to try, you know, from the there's a plan there. There's an agenda there from the Saarland to Anschluss to Czechoslovakia to Poland to invading France to, and ultimately his Waterloo in the Soviet Union. And so I would expect that Iran will now tell its domestic opposition, "What were you guys upset about? We got prestige, we got a legacy, we're going to get the bomb." It's going to deflate that, and then it's going to tell Hezbollah, "We've got $150 billion freed up. We want you to do this. We're going to buy weapons. We're going to sell oil." And it's going to take a lot more risk. The president, remember, in his speech the other day said, "Well, just because people chant death to America, that doesn't mean the people feel that way." Well, what would it matter if they did or did not? We don't have polls of Germany in 1939 or 40, but I'd give them the benefit of the doubt and said most of them, if asked in 1942, "Would you want to set up an apparatus to kill 6 million Jews?" They might say no. It mattered nothing. I mean, it's not a democracy in Iran, so I don't see what the president was trying to say, that this deal is suddenly going to make Iranians appreciate the magnanimity of the United States. They have no say in their government at all. They can't affect it one way or the other. It's a dictatorship, a theocratic dictatorship with a facade of voting and a republic. When he says death to America, don't take that seriously. Will the supreme commander, the supreme head of Iran, Khamenei, said, not just death to America, he just published a 400-page book outlining the agenda to destroy Israel. So I don't know how you can get any more provocative than that. And finally, when the president suggested that there was an alliance of sort, or at least they were working at similar purposes, the Iranian hardliners and the Republican caucus, he was essentially saying that his opponents in Congress are, what, comparable to theocratic fascists in Iran? And then I wondered, who would that be? Would that be Chuck Schumer? Would it be 55% of the American people who are skeptical of this deal? And when he talks about these are the same crowd that voted for the Iraqi war, I thought, does that include John Kerry? Does it include Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Thomas Friedman, Fareed Zakaria, Joe Klein? So he's very inarticulate. He's all over the map on these issues. He's historically misinformed, and he's got a chip on his shoulder, venomous dislike of anybody who dare question his authority. And that's a formula for failure. And this deal is bad news.
Victor, there's a tendency among Western diplomats, John Kerry is sort of an archetypal example of this, to treat adversarial powers as if they're laboring under a sort of false consciousness. I mean, we saw this with Russia, where Kerry sort of condescended to Vladimir Putin by saying that Russian aggression wasn't really in the country's self-interest. And there's a similar line out there now about Iran. There's a bit of an irony, isn't there, that the people who in a domestic context are the most deferential to multiculturalism never seem to acknowledge that other countries, other regimes may understand what's at stake in these conflicts in a way different than we do.
Yeah, and I think, again, I don't want to beat the president's speech to death, but he said something that resonated with what you just said, because he said, if we free up this money, then the regime will be forced to spend it on domestic programs, and that will create ever increased expectation. He was talking as if these people think as if they are
European-style social democratic technocrats. And he, in Obama's mind, it just can't be possible that the Iranian hierarchy believes that if we use this money and this prestige of basically beating the United States at this deal, and we show aggression to our neighbors, we're going to get more power, more honor, more glory. And not only are we going to like that, but our own population is going to bask in that reflected glory. That's how they think. But it is condescending for Obama to feel that, you know, they're postmodern liberals like he is. And there's absolutely no chance that that's going to happen. They're not going to take this windfall of released cash and use it to set up a version of Obamacare in Iran. It's just not going to happen. But the idea that you'd even think that is pretty delusional.
You touched on this briefly a moment ago, but let's talk a little bit more about the position that this puts Israel in. If you listen to Israeli politicians, you will hear some variation of the following. There's never a political consensus in this country. We're always duking it out in the Knesset, sometimes literally. But nearly everyone in Israel agrees that this is a bad deal. So where does that leave them? Let's assume that there aren't two-thirds majorities in both houses of Congress to override this deal. It goes through. The U.S., at least the executive branch, which is what counts most here, is at best indifferent to Israeli concerns. There are some hints that it may be something closer to outright dismissive. What's the thought process, if you're Israel at that point, for how you deal with this threat?
Well, you have two considerations. One, if you were to preempt, are you sure that over a 2 or 3 week period that might be necessary, the Obama administration would guarantee accords on arms resupply? Or would you be in some situation like during the Yom Kippur War, where the Nixon administration under Henry Kissinger for 2 or 3 days held back as a way of leveraging Israel? And I don't think that they're at all sure that the United States would honor its commitments and keep supplying bunker busters to the Israeli Air Force. So they have legitimate worries about that. And I think the Obama administration will play on that and sort of suggest, hint, wink, whatever, that that might be in fact true. And then the second and the only other consideration is, will Iran under this agreement get a bomb before Obama goes out of office, or will somebody more conducive to Israel be elected and then radically change American foreign policy and support Israel, or at least maybe even preempt themselves, or at least ratchet up the sanctions? So I think they're trying to huddle together and saying, will they get a bomb before Obama leaves office? If they think they will, they'll risk preempting, even if it means they may be cut off by the Obama administration. And I think my sense is they're going to try to risk it and go the next 15 months and try to drag things out, hoping that maybe Iran won't be so flagrant that the next president will come in and Iran won't yet have the bomb, and then we'll work with the Israelis. But the dangers we talked about in past interviews is that all of our allies are going to come to us and say, we don't want to enrich uranium any more than the Iranians do. We just want the same agreement that you gave them. And that's what the Soviet Union said after Munich. They said, I'd rather be a friend of Hitler than a friend of these guys. And then once they cut the deal, the Soviet Union said they didn't say anything about taking Czechoslovakia. So we're going to join in Poland. We took Poland, and we're going to carve up the Baltic republics. We'll take them too. The democracies won't do anything about that. It wasn't just Hitler. It sets a precedent everywhere. Well, Putin's looking at this agreement too, as are the Chinese. And when they see it, they're going to say, you know what? Wow, there's no consequences for aggression. Maybe we can get a nice long strategic negotiation ongoing with the Obama administration as we go into the Baltic Republic.
So, final question. At this point, where do you put the odds that the situation with Iran ends up eventually being resolved by something other than outright military conflict?
If you mean by that question, if this deal goes through and the Senate and House do not raise a two-thirds vote to overturn it, I would say that there's 100% chance that this deal will not stop Iran from getting the bomb. it's almost assured that it will, and much quicker than 10 to 15 years. There's never been any evidence with this government that they've ever followed any accord. They have never shown any moderation, and there is a great deal of evidence that outreach is considered not magnanimity, but weakness to be despised. So they're going to be empowered, and that message is going to go out to the Yemenis, to the Syrians, to the Lebanese, to the Iraqis, and they're going to say that we just defeated the United States in negotiations. We didn't have much of an economy. We were under all sorts of international sanctions, and we still pulled it off. Just think now what's going to happen. When the money comes in, the oil goes, we can buy weapons. So we're going to be more powerful than we were when we already defeated the United States in these negotiations. And now we're going to really tell the world, and you in particular, in the Middle East, that you have to make a deal with us. Either you're going to have to join us, or you're going to be crushed by us, or you're going to have to make the necessary concessions. And that message is going out not to just people like Hamas and Hezbollah, but also Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt. And they're saying right now, well, the United States is obviously not there for us. So we either have to cut a deal and acquiesce with Iran, or we have to buy a bomb from Pakistan, or we got to go back and we've got to tell the United States that we're going to enrich uranium, and you can't be any more judgmental on us than you were on the Iranians. And then if you think Iran won't get a bomb, then don't worry about us getting a bomb. So I think it's 100% that we're going to have a war in the Middle East. There's no way around it.
All right. That's all the time that we have for today. Join us next week for the next installment of the Classicist podcast. And in the meantime, stop by hoover.org, where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.